Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. Actually, this episode is sponsored by a friend of the Svarim Chatter podcast. He said to say in support of all the Svarim Chatter does. He wanted to sponsor a show about modern history, and they haven't had a lot of those, but today we're going to be doing one that is about modern history. So for this show, we're going to have Dan Rabinowitz, who's the author of the excellent book, I think I can say, The Lost Library, The Legacy of Vilna's Strachan Library in the Aftermath of the Holocaust. So, Dan, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So, why don't you start off, just tell listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm an attorney by trade, but I also spend a considerable amount of time and effort on books, and specifically Hebrew books. I'm a book collector. I also write and speak about Hebrew books, and I also have a website that's devoted to the history of the Jewish book.
And I think we should mention the website's name. I think it's very well known, I think, especially to listeners to this podcast, which is the Svarim blog. So I need to start off. I guess that's something everyone's been interested in. We haven't really discussed that. Is how did the Svarim blog start?
Well, I do not have the benefit of living in New York City or any of its close environs. And I still have an interest and a passion for Hebrew books. And where I live, there are few and far between people that are similarly like-minded. So this was back, I think, in the early 2000s that I decided that the thing to do was to, start a blog, of course. And I would start posting articles, and if five people read it, it'd be great. I'd have five more people to talk to than I had at the time. And then the other hope is that because it was just a blog, I could write whatever I wanted to write from whatever perspective I wanted to write. And that's what happened. And ultimately we are, you know, far more successful than I ever thought that we would be. Both in terms of the number of readers, the geographic breadth of those readers, as well as most critically, now the variety of contributors. There's so many people that contribute across the academic spectrum, from, you know, full professors to people that have no academic training. I really think that's a real value add, to have a forum for all those different kinds of speakers.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's really part, I think, the beauty of the Svarim blog is you get academics writing on there all the time, professors, Janelle Lyman's writing on there, and Mark Shapiro, and then you have regular people, so to speak, writing. It's an outlet for them to write something, otherwise there wouldn't be necessarily. Yeah. I think that's, so you mentioned at the outset that you collect Svarim and books. So how'd you get into Svarim and Jewish history and book collecting? But you always drawn to that at a young age? Was that a later thing?
So I certainly was always into reading books. But when it came to Hebrew books, and in particular the histories of the Hebrew books, that was actually, I want to say, was triggered by a particular book. I was exposed to this book in a sort of an odd way. I attended a particular shiur, a Chumash shiur, on Thursday night. That was it was to mimic the Chumash shiur that was done at Rav Avram Yeshua's, and it was a bunch of Brisker guys. And the person giving it one week brought up this sefer, and he said that there's a sefer called Besamim Rosh, the Tshuvas Besamim Rosh. And then he said, but it's a forgery. And then he said, and not only is it a forgery, the person who forged it also wrote the footnotes. So you can imagine, like, the entire time that you're in yeshiva, you only learn about like five Svarim tops, you know, whatever it is, 15 Svarim tops. And then to learn about like their tshuva Svarim, fine, like they're actually tshuva Svarim, but really you're only interested in Rabbi Akiva and the Shagas Aryeh, but you don't really realize like they're real tshuvas. They're not just lumpish things. Anyways, then you get to the fact that this guy took a tshuva sefer, forged the thing, and then forged something else. You're like, wow, there must be more out there. So I was just amazed by that. And, you know, at the same time, it certainly wasn't something that I could, you know, just get on my own. And it took a while actually to get materials about that, but that became part of the collecting. Because this particular book, the Besamim Rosh, was so intriguing, and it sort of forced me to start trying to get as much as I could on it immediately.
So, so that's where you started at. Now, you moved on to, so do you collect like just new editions, the good edition stuff, or you also collect old, actually antique svarim as well?
So I generally collect for a particular purpose other than simply age or rarity. I don't want to say every book, but certainly I try that I have a reason for each book that I have, and it falls within two broad categories, I would say. One are books that I'm using. I just like the ability to have everything. So if I'm, you know, learning a topic or whatever it is, I just try to have all the books on that topic. And then additionally, I collect books that are themselves part of history. So the idea of having the artifact, an actual physical artifact of a historical event, I think is a very powerful thing about books. So, you know, if I will have, you know, and then different books in different areas. So for example, forgeries like the Besamim Rosh. But then, like I mentioned earlier when we were talking, like illustrated books. So I have a variety of categories that I collect in, and then also a variety of categories that I actually just use books in.
Interesting. Okay, definitely understandable. So I guess let's get to the topic we're here to discuss, which is the book, The Lost Library. So how did you get it? We'll get it more in depth, but how did you just get to that topic? What attracted you to this topic?
So I, in the course of collecting books, I've met a number of book dealers. And one of them who I regularly interact with, he's a particularly eccentric, I generally try to go because he has a large number of books that I'm particularly interested in. Anyways, I was going through books in his warehouse to find a book that had very interesting book stamps. So I am not great at paleography, which is, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, the handwriting. So if something has like a signature, rabbinic signature, I can't figure it out. But when it has a stamp, it's very easy. So there were these books that had all these stamps in them. And in particular, it had Matisyahu Strauss-Sohn's stamp. And I knew about Matisyahu Strauss-Sohn. And I knew he was a book collector. And then I also noticed that there were these additional stamps to it that also seemed to trace a very interesting history of the book. And in particular, there were two stamps that actually seemed mutually exclusive. One placed it in New York, one placed it in Israel, some of it didn't make sense. And after I bought the book, mainly because it belonged to Matisyahu, I then started investigating the history of the stamps. And that's really where I fell down that rabbit hole of investigating the history of the Strauss-Sohn Library.
Okay. So let's start off at the beginning. I think the book takes this trajectory, so to speak. It starts off with the city of Vilna. I think it's Vilnius today, right, in Lithuania, and its Jewish history. So why don't you set the tone before we get to the library?
Oh, sure. So Vilna or Vilnius, Jews always call this some form of Vilna, is a city that Jews date there from the 15th century. But in particular, in the 17th and 18th century was really where it found its footing and then became world-renowned and considered the greatest city in Eastern Europe, in pre-World War II Eastern Europe. It was both in terms of the importance, in other words, the people that were there, who they were, the personalities, also in terms of the numbers of Jews. Vilna was a very Jewish city. The Jews lived in a high percentage compared to their non-Jewish neighbors, and also the Jewish quarter is actually in the middle of the older part of the city. So Jews and non-Jews mingled all the time. Jews were generally restricted to a particular area. Nonetheless, their Jews expanded beyond there, and certainly Jews had a relationship with their non-Jewish neighbors, and they really were integral to the larger Vilna operation. Of course, in the 18th century, we get the Vilna Gaon, and that's what really, of course, establishes and puts Vilna on the map. And then from then on, it's off to the races, and Vilna becomes the great city that it was up until 1940.
Have you been to Vilna?
Yes, I have a couple times. It's a fascinating city. First of all, there are parts of it that are very, very medieval, and it has a certain like old European charm to it. The Jewish quarter, where the Jews lived for 500 or some odd years, was pretty much totally destroyed during the Holocaust. Nonetheless, for the most part, when it was rebuilt, it's rebuilt in the very same style. The houses look pretty much the exact same. The streets bend in the same way. They're the same sizes and so on. There were minor adjustments that were deliberately done by the Soviets in order to actually make it appear that certain parts of the Jewish quarter weren't as large as they were. So they moved streets around a little bit. But the overall impression is that it's very, very similar to what it was like in 1939. So if you took a picture from 1939 and held it up and looked down the street with that picture, with the exception of an arch where a lot of them are missing, it looks the same. So it certainly has that feel, although again, like none of the things are there. So one of the things that Vilna was known for was the Great Synagogue. The Great Synagogue was where everyone davened. It was the and it was an incredibly impressive building by itself. And the way in part that they did this was that they had a very, very large space inside that went up very, very high. The way they were able to do that was they dug down because they were restricted by zoning laws to the top. It could only go up so high. So in Vilna, what they did in order to get the same internal space, they dug down. So it had this amazing effect. And there's, I have described in the book where this non-Jewish German soldier during World War I comes upon the shul and how moved he was when he got there. So, it was, so that was there, and today that's no longer there. So that's certainly like a major, major loss, although they are doing excavations now to try to find pieces of it, and they've been successful in identifying aspects of the old synagogue. But certainly there's at least a feeling that of what it was at some point.
Right, and the Gaon Clothes was nearby. He had his own thing, right?
So the Vilna Gaon's Clothes was in the area called the Great Synagogue Courtyard, the Shulhaif. And as part of the many buildings that were there, one of them was the Vilna Gaon's Clothes. It was when you came in from Jew Street, there were three major streets, and Jew Street, Judengasse, was the street of that the main entrance. So when you came into the main entrance, you would walk through these two massive iron gates, and to your left would be the Vilna Gaon's Clothes. Ahead of you would be the Great Synagogue, and to your right, after 1902, would be the Strausson Library. So the Strausson Library would be to your right, Vilna Gaon's Clothes is to your left, and the Great Synagogue is directly in front.
During his lifetime, he davened in his clothes, or he davened in the shul?
No, so there is evidence that he did spend time in this clothes. There was another building that he had access to that he probably spent most of the time in. He had either a second building, or he had a building in his where he had space in his house that he also taught in. But the Vilna Gaon, he certainly didn't spend considerable time there. That's not where he was. But he did attend the Vilna Gaon's clothes. Yes.
So it's really named after after him.
Yes.
Gotcha. Yeah. So obviously we'll get to the Rashash, the father of Matisyahu, but that they were a bit after the Gaon. So what was the Gaon's lasting influence until the Rashash's time and then until Matisyahu's time on Vilna and on the Jewry of Vilna?
So the Rashash is really the first generation of students that followed the Vilna Gaon. If you think about the Netziv being another, there's a bunch of others, but that's probably the most prominent. So these are people that were in Vilna or were in the Vilna circle and were affected by the ideas of the Vilna Gaon. And in particular, this idea of the centrality of studying beyond just the Talmud Bavli and even the Yerushalmi. But there's especially Gil Pearl identifies the focus on Medrash as being one of the lasting influences, the general idea of a broader understanding of what Torah Shabbat Peh is, and spending time on that. So that's what the first generation did. So they, if you will, took the Vilna Gaon and that's the way that they were implementing it. Then you had the second generation, which is the generation of Ma Tusiao and his cohorts. These were, if you will, the Sabra. So these were kids that were born from these more enlightened parents, as opposed to the non-native born. And as a consequence, they went a bit further than that first generation. And in particular, the way that I would suggest that they went further is that they certainly look beyond these more obscure areas of Torah Shebaal Peh, and they were more actively involved in incorporating secular studies into the everyday study of Torah. And you know, it's important to keep in mind that when you use a particular term, one always has to be careful how to define it. And in different cultures and in different locales, the same word can have very, very different meaning. And this is especially sensitive when you have words that not only carry a particular meaning, but also can be used pejoratively. So if you can, you know, just deploy that at will, even if it has no relevance, you know, people can shut down conversations. And the word here in particular is maskil or haskalah. And haskalah, and this is a very, very like a gross exaggeration, but at the same time, the way perhaps to view haskalah, putting them in large buckets, are you have the Berlin haskalah, then you have the haskalah that you have in where the Maritzkias is and Rappaport and Czechoslovakia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And then you have the Haskalah of the North, which is this Lithuanian Haskalah. And there, certainly the Berlin Haskalah is identified with a shift, not only in terms of philosophical outlook, but also in terms of religious practice. So there is no question that there were people that were involved in the Haskalah and used the Haskalah in a way to diminish the religiosity. And that certainly characterized at least some aspects of the Berlin Haskalah. When it comes to the Haskalah of the North, and in particular the Haskalah of Lithuania, that was noted by the fact that they people that associated with it, at least in the first generation in the early to mid 19th century, they remained staunchly religious. And they really, for them, Haskalah simply meant we're not just gonna learn the traditional Svarim or whatever it may be. I'm also gonna learn Russian. Now, I'm gonna learn Latin. Why am I gonna learn Latin? Because I want to be able to read aspects of the Aruch that he's citing to Latin words, and I want to know the Latin words that he's citing to. And I also want to be able to see if there are other Latin words that maybe he didn't pick up on. But the point was for them to do it as a way to enhance to enhance their Torah study. So it wasn't a means to an end in the sense that it would be to lower their religious practices or to do anything of the like. It was just a different subject matter, a subject matter that had not otherwise been incorporated, and now they understood it to be valuable. So therefore, of course, they're going to incorporate that. And that, it goes back to what really Vilna was. Vilna wasn't just, if you think about Vilna, it was much more than a city. It's this very idea. And the idea of Vilna, I think, is the idea of pursuing intellectualism, but not intellectualism in the high-minded sense, like just, you know, purely intellect. Instead, what it is, it's this innate desire to engage with intelligence. And that can be represented in many different ways. So yes, in the scholar, it's by, you know, some esoteric discussion. But what you also saw in Vilna are even, you know, lay people, when it comes to what we'll talk about later, the Strassen Library, they also came to the library to read books. So there was this this aspect to the city, I think, that went beyond even like its structures, like I was talking about before. It even went to the ethos and just the way that I think people lived.
Right. Did the Gaon at the Gaon's time, was the Gaon himself, have anything to do with any of this or no?
For the most part, the Gaon had a very small number of students. You know, as you well know, none of this, he didn't publish anything in his lifetime, really. It certainly didn't have the effect. It's all the students that come after, people that align themselves with with those students. That's really where you see the explosion. But certainly contemporaneous with the Gura, no, he did not have that immediate. It was a slow effect.
Right. Even the Berliner School, I think, was only beginning at that time. Really later, a lot of it. So I guess that really sets the stage for Vilna at the time when we get to we'll discuss the first generation again. So we get to the Rashash, and I guess. Speak about his background a little before we get to his sons.
So the Rashash is Rebbe Shmuel Strassun, and he took the name Strassun, the famous name Strassun, because his father-in-law was actually from the town of Strassun. I had someone approach me once, and they thought that they were related to Matisyahu. I asked them a couple of questions, and they had the last name Strassun, and it became apparent to me that they had no relationship, and the sad thing was that I didn't want to say, in all likelihood, the most people that have the last name Strassun is because they came from that city, not because they were actually related to Shmuel Strassun. Anyways, be it as it may, Shmuel Strassun was, as his last name implies, at some point was in Strassun. He was expelled during one of the wars. He ended up in Vilna. His father-in-law was very wealthy. He set him up in a close at the time that he would be able to study. And ultimately, he is perhaps most well known for an unbelievable achievement, and that was pretty much writing notes on every single page of Talmud Bavli. There's a handful he missed. Most of those are half pages, so they don't really count. It's like the last page, and it's like half an omelet or something. So he covered pretty much everything there. And I think that's really his lasting legacy. He is also, although he was that first generation, so he did have interest beyond the Gemara. He also wrote on Medrash. He wrote on other things as well. And he also, at least to a limited degree, very very limited degree, there's some evidence that he was engaged in some form of secular studies. Limited degree, may have read some of Mendelssohn's, but he certainly wasn't, and he did support, which actually I think is probably more. Says more than the other things. He did support Levinson's publication of Tudab Yisrael. He was one of the subscribers. And that actually is important, I think, because even before it came out, it was known that it was espousing a Maskilic view. So he certainly wasn't against it. I don't know how for it he was, but I think he certainly was not against it.
Right. And as you said, his claim to fame, so to speak, is being in the Shas, and he has Hagoyis and Chedushim. How did he get in there? What was his connection to the Rum press, and how did he get inside of the Gemara?
So I think, you first have to qualify, like, get into the Gemara. Like, you make it seem like there's like a committee or something and you have to get past it. I mean, most of these things are happenstance.
Well, there's two stories that I want to ask you about. One story, and you have an issue. Oh, he was a rich guy and he paid for the publication and he helped pay for it. And that's why they put him in there. Like, okay, he was like a backer and he paid for it. That's one thing. The other one I really want to ask you about, we'll get back to that one in a second, was the story with the table. He had the table with the Sfarim and he would turn it. You never heard this story? The legend, and he would, and therefore he had no Amelus. You never heard this yeshivish story?
No, so it isn't him. It's a Leket Yosher. It's posed as a question whether or not it was a good thing to have these turntables. It's like one of the Rishonim talks about.
It makes sense what you're saying. Now something. And Yeshiva's always said about the Rashash. But getting back to that thing about
Rashash was related to Ram. And the Rashash probably also gave money to Ram. Now, does that mean that they would publish his thing just because of that? So first, I mean, we should take a step back and say, well, what did Ram decide to include in the Vilna Shas, and it was many, many things. They tried to get a hold of as many commentaries as they could, and they were very good business people. So their one approach, and perhaps this is like the most simple one, is that the Rashash's Hagos are actually worthwhile. He was actually a known quantity, and if they want to sell volumes, so they put him in there. An incredibly cynical one would be that he only got in there because he paid money. He wrote notes on every single page of Shas, every single one. Like that's a huge achievement. And the idea that he somehow wasn't worthy, or it was simply because of the money, I think is highly unlikely and frankly borderline offensive. But yeah, he was related, but there's no evidence that the inclusion has anything to do with that.
Okay, good. I wanted to clarify. It's not something that I necessarily believe. It's something that I want people listening to in yeshiva. They some reason this is like, I remember this being one of the stories. So be someone who researched the family. I wanted to, okay, let me ask you this. Okay, gotcha. So Ramat Yisyo, now let's give a background on him and how was he raised and his upbringing.
So Ramat Yisyo was he had a very broad upbringing. He both had a traditional upbringing. It's like a classic case, right? He went to learn. He was very proficient by the time he was 13. He was actually quoted in a sefer. He rewrote a small thing when he was 13. He ended up, speaking 8 languages, either having some amount of proficiency in. And it is interesting that, you know, in his svarim, he would sometimes sign in his svarim, not only in Hebrew, but also in Russian. He would sign his name in Russian. So it wasn't simply like he knew Russian. He was actually signing it in, you know, if for us it'd be Latin characters, right? It would, so he was exposed to that. And also at a young age, he also began collecting books. We have evidence that when he was very young, probably around 13 or so, maybe a little older, that he was already started collecting books. He also at a young age was also in touch with, and he certainly is much more aligned with the Lithuanian Haskalah. He was in personal contact with Levinson. He has letters back and forth. And it's obvious that Levinson's books made a very, very significant impression upon him. And again, Levinson's book, To W. Yisrael, is really a book that simply posits that you can engage in secular studies and secular society, and that's still well within the confines of Orthodox Judaism. And then, you know, he shows why it's so important for everything else. But, you know, so certainly at the time was somewhat radical, but at the same time, it was something that Ramat Yisyo was firmly embedded in. I mean, again, he was personally corresponding with it.
And another thing I want to mention, when he was young, I believe he got married at 13?
Got married at 13, yes.
Wow. And he didn't have any kids. Is that right? Or he did
have 4 kids. He had, I believe, 4 kids.
I believe. I mean, did they die before young?
Yes. So he had 2 kids that died very young. He had one, I'm just trying to remember all of them. And then I want to say he had 2 boys and 2 girls. And by the time, they all predeceased him, but two died very young, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right, that's right. Well, predeceased him. I mean, he didn't have
living. Right, but there is this idea that goes around that he was childless. He was not childless. His children predeceased him.
Perfect. Thanks for the correction. Okay. So one more thing, I guess we'll go back to the Shas, and really applies here as well, is Ramat Yisyo ended up in, I believe, 2 Masechtas, right? In the back of the Gemara.
I think it's 3 or 4. I meant to check.
I forget also as well. I know it's more than one. I wasn't sure how many.
I think it's 3 or 4. I know it's Baba Basra, and I'm trying to remember the other 2 right now.
Baba Basra is a famous one. I think that's where everybody in Yeshiva encounters him in the back of the Gemara.
But he wrote, he was an incredibly prolific writer. Most of his writing, though, was in the form of newspapers. The Hebrew newspapers, the serious newspapers. Some of his earliest writing was actually in the first Haskalah periodical called Pirchei Tzafon. He wrote in that one. He has 2 actually very important articles on Shem Tov Ben Shem Tov. He even corresponds eventually with Steinschneider. But most of his writing was in that form. A lot of it was pseudonymously. He didn't use his name. He used abbreviations. Some of those have been identified, but certainly not all of them. He did write also a commentary on Medrash that was published posthumously, part of it. But beyond that, there really isn't anything that he published in his own lifetime. But he was still incredibly well known.
Right. So now we'll get to the main subject of the book. So he had a big library, he was a big collector. So talk a little bit about his library, how he built the collection, and when did that start, and how did it progress?
Sure. So as I said, he started pretty young, and he started collecting when I say he started collecting young, it wasn't like an immature collection. So it wasn't like he started with starting collecting, you know, Svarim on Gemara, and then that slowly spread out. No, at the very beginning, he was already collecting very broad range of Svarim, both in Hebrew as well in German. He was also collecting books. And he actually already collected some rare books and some very important books, both by Jews and non-Jews, when he was younger. We don't know exactly which book dealers he specifically dealt with. We know that he certainly dealt with Reb Nassan Nata Rabinowitz, the Dikduke Sofrim. But others, we don't know. Vilna had a very decent book trade. There were a couple of large collections that were actually sold during his lifetime in Vilna. He likely purchased some of those. But ultimately, he built up a collection around 6,500 volumes, both Jewish and non-Jewish. He had around 5,700-ish of Hebrew and Yiddish, and then the remainder, some 1,500 or so, were in non-Jewish languages. And what was critical about his library was that it was not singularly focused on this particular topic or subject matter. Instead, it was very, very broad, very broad. And that breadth included everything from Jewish philosophy to, you know, books on Jewish books on math, to Yiddish plays, to Tshuva Svarim. He actually had a very, very large collection of Tshuva Svarim. It's probably it makes up the largest single subject matter in the collection. But nonetheless, the collection was designed to cover everything, to cover all of Jewish literature, from poetry to Mefarshim on Shas, and in all languages. So it really was designed to be a much broader library, I think, or a library that we associate more today with what a library means. That a library isn't limited to particular subjects. It's when especially a public library, which we'll talk about in a moment, but certainly those that it's supposed to afford you the opportunity just to find what you're interested in.
Right. So there weren't like specific subject matter that he was interested. Can we look at it and see that he was interested in certain things over the other, or just in general?
It's incredible. I mean, a catalog of his library was published posthumously. There was only the Hebrew and the Yiddish. It did not include any of the German and the other languages. When you go through that, you see that it pretty much covers everything. Like I said, it could be poetry. It could be, I could open up any page and I'm sure, you know, I could go down and it's right. It's actually a book that he wrote here. It's just pages and pages of different things, of like drushos, of Kabbalah, of authors from Italy, of authors from all over from the Eastern Europe, from Western Europe, of Sephardim, Ashkenazim, and it covers everything. Does a really great job in the actual small number of books that it is. And again, 5,700 is not that many books, but still he does cover a lot of ground. He has all the polemics in the Emden Eibschitz, for example.
So where was this, 5,700 is still pretty large, especially back in those days. Where was the, you know, nowadays every old one book becomes four, but back then it wasn't like that. So where was it housed during his lifetime, and was it publicly accessible during his lifetime, or was it a private collection?
So he actually lived around the block from where the Great Synagogue was. He lived on what was called German Street or Deutsche Gasse. It was one of the main streets in Vilna, and it was a very prestigious street. He was very well to do, very, very well to do. He had a variety of holdings, but then also he actually sat on a bank, and he was one of the wealthiest Jews in Vilna at the time. So he had a very nice house, and in the house he had a library. We don't know the details of what it looked like. But to your question, which I think is the most important aspect of it, was whether or not it was public. It certainly was open to the public. He was known, people knew it as a place that they could go, that they could find the book, that he would have it, and that they would be able to use it. And what was interesting is just like the library, the personalities were also varied. In other words, because the library carried such an eclectic subject matter, so the people that naturally came exposed to it were also different. They were from the Haskalah to the more traditional rabbis, so and everything in between. And they actually, people describe how unusual it was to have those people together all under the same roof while he was alive. And that was due to his library.
Right. So when he died, we mentioned that all his children predeceased him. So what happened to the library when he died? I guess also we should set the table for a bit later in a little bit. What year did he die as well?
So he died in 1882, I think. yeah, it's, sorry, 1885. I don't know why. I was thinking 82. Anyways, he died in 1885. He died in November of 1885. And as you said, he didn't have any children. And the question was what to do with his library. And he already made a decision and determination what to do about his library before he died. He actually, again, to go back to the fact that he was proficient in other languages, he actually drafted his own will in Russian. And in his will, he makes a place for his library. And in particular, he does something which was unheard of at the time. And unique in Jewish history, and that was rather to donate the library to an institution or other private entity or person, he gifted it to the community, to the Vilna Jewish community, thereby making it a public institution. Which that there were yeshiva libraries and there were paying libraries, but this would be a public free library. And he provided both the books, his entire collection for that. As well as he provided a piece of property that would produce income that would sustain it. The idea was that it would have its own building. Unfortunately, as with so many communal projects, things take a lot longer than they otherwise should. And it would not be until 1901, but really 1902, that the library opened up in a standalone, independent building. It went through other iterations before that, but its real opening to the public was in 1902. So a good 17 years after he died.
And so did the library have a full-time librarian? And effectively, the library was from 1902, and we'll get to this, until World War II?
We can talk about, but It certainly did have a librarian. It actually typically had two librarians. And the most important of the librarians, in fact, some of Strelsun's nephew served as a librarian and other people from Strelsun's family. But the most important librarian was one by the name of Chaiko Lunsky. Chaiko Lunsky was a Slonimer Chassid who also was incredibly well-read. I mean, incredibly well-read. He read everything. And was involved in anything having to do with academic pursuits or intellectual pursuits in Vilna. He sat on the museum, the Anski Museum, and he was involved in YIVO, and he was involved in, he wrote a history of the Vilna Ghetto, and then he wrote a history of Hasidus. So he'd done anything and everything he touched. He really just had a phenomenal encyclopedic command of Jewish literature. And he was the most important librarian that the Strelsun Library had, because he made sure that the library was so heterogeneous, that there was so much there that covered so many different subjects and that appealed to so many different people. And he totally gave his heart and soul to the library. He spent 12 to 14 hours in the library. They paid him incredibly poorly. He had to beg for money all the time. He had to beg the board and others to give him money. And then at the same time, he'd work these 12 to 14 hour days, and then he would come home and he would spend the next 2 to 3 hours trying to catalog the books in the library on his own time, because he wanted to make a catalog of the larger library. Because of course, after Strelsun gave his library and they had a standalone building, that they started buying books for the library and expanding it from the 5,500 to eventually, right before the Holocaust, it was actually at, we actually know it's around 50,000 books. So in a very short period of time, it exploded. And that was due to Lunsky. And Lunsky knew where every book was also. So even though there wasn't a catalog, he knew exactly where every book was. You would come, immediately he would go get it. He was the living catalog. If you read the book, there's an interesting semi-fictional story that sort of captures that, but I think it's worth reading other than I don't do it justice. But so Lunsky as a librarian was perhaps the, other than Strasser, and I would argue Lunsky was equally important in ensuring the real legacy of the library. But what happened was, you asked about up to 1940. So the reason that we know there were 50,000-ish books was because in September 1939, of course, Germany and Russia both executed on their plan, and they split up more or less Eastern Europe into two halves. And the Soviets occupied Vilna. And at that time, Vilna was actually part of Poland. But then after a couple months, the Russians or the Soviets elected to leave Vilna. And but before they left, they nationalized the library. So technically, at that point in time, the Stralsund Library, as with all libraries, became nationalized. But the reality was it still operated. But while they were there, this is how you get to the 50,000, they actually attempted to do their own cataloging of the library, and they did a fairly a decent headcount, if you will. And they have a list that puts it at that 50,000. So we essentially know that from the 1902, from the time, excuse me, that Strasser died in 1885 until 1940, the library expanded to that amount. But what happened was is in 1940, the Soviets come and they go. But the library actually, at least partially, remains open. The Soviets return in May of 1940, and then the Nazis come in 41, a year later. And when with the Nazis comes the end of the Stralsund books as part of the larger Stralsund library. The Nazis had a program whereby they would create, famously, a university to study the Jewish race. And as any good university has to have a good library. So how do you get a library if you're the Nazis? And so rather than actually, you know, taking the time to build it and buy it, et cetera, they decided that they would just loot it. They would loot existing libraries and then create their own library for this institute. So they actually, being German, they actually had a section that focused just on this, just on getting looting Jewish artifacts and books. And Vilna, not only did it have the Stralsund Library, it had at least three other very, very large libraries, putting it in the category of one of the most significant bibliographical, I guess, city in Eastern Europe for books. So when the Nazis came, the Stralsund Library, of course, was one of the things they were most interested in. And they wanted to send the books to Frankfurt, where this university would be built. In an effort to minimize the number of books that would have to be sent, because they were now faced with tens of thousands of books and they're not going to ship them all back, the Nazis started a sorting process whereby they enlisted Jews, and the Jews would go ahead and pick the books that were most valuable, and those would be sent back. Now, at this point in time, we get to what happened to the library in 1940, and that was is that it was rendered into two parts. One part ended up in Germany, and one part remained in Vilna. And the part that remained in Vilna was due to the people that were sorting it. They, on the penalty of their own lives, smuggled out books and hid them in bunkers within the Jewish ghetto. And they did this for thousands of books. There were thousands of books that they smuggled out and put in these bunkers to hide them under the Nazis' watchful eye. What happened was is the books that were removed to Frankfurt after the war, discovered by the American army. And what was interesting is the books that the Nazis were so overwhelmed with books that most of the time they didn't even unpack them. So the Stralsund Library books were still in their original crates from Vilna. They had never been unpacked. The library, and it was by itself. So they had a section that was just Stralsund books where the American army was housing this. And at that time is when we get to a shift in the story. We now get another entity that sort of makes itself known. And then this shifts the Stralsund Library out of Europe into the United States.
Right. So before we get there, I wanted to mention, first of all, on the smuggling going on in Vilna, I believe David Fishman has his book, The Book Smugglers, is about that.
Yes. Yeah. So there were two examples of this. One was at the Strassen Library, where they were doing the sorting. And the second one, which David focuses on, is at the YIVO building. YIVO had a massive library and a truly tremendous archive. Their library, although slightly smaller than the Strassen, was around 40,000 volumes. Incredibly impressive library, and then also archives. And the Nazis had the same issue that they had with the Strassen Library, and that was there was too much to just take everything. So they similarly had these sorters at YIVO, and they would smuggle it out and also bury it in the ghetto. There it was even more outrageous because YIVO was actually located outside of the ghetto. So they were smuggling into the ghetto, not like food or other things. These people were smuggling, that's why they call them the paper brigade, because they're smuggling paper, which is just so absurd and just shows the lengths that we'll go to in order to protect our heritage and culture. But yes, but he absolutely talks about that. It's a fascinating story as well, how they did that, how some of that survived. It's truly amazing.
Right. I think they even just translated the book into Hebrew recently, like a month ago or something. I believe it just came out with Magnus. I think so. So before we get to YIVO and what happened with the Strassen Library, why don't you tell the listeners, what is YIVO? They may have heard the name. They've seen it online in New York today. But how did it come about? What does it stand for? And then how did, I guess, the history of YIVO that it became to the U.S.? I guess there's a lot in that question.
Yeah, so there's a lot. And I'm certainly not an expert in YIVO. But the basic contours are, I think it was in the 20s or 30s, terrible with dates, this group of people got together and decided to open up an institute. It was an institute that would do a variety of things, but in the main, it was for the study of Yiddish culture. And the main idea behind it, and again, I'm not an expert, but essentially it was that Jewish history needs to not only focus on the elite, but Jewish history is really comprised of everyone, the folk, and therefore it's important to study things about the folk. So that might be ethnography, or it might be Yiddish language. And in terms of Yiddish, they certainly were Yiddishist. They view Yiddish as like a quasi-national language, and really integral to Judaism. So they created an institute, the YIVO Institute, which was located in Vilna. And they had offices and other locations throughout Europe, as well as in other countries in the world. They famously had a huge map in their Vilna headquarters that had pins from all over the world where all the YIVO offices were at the time, or affiliates. And one of those offices was in New York. So they had a New York branch, and then Vilna was the main branch, though. And that was the branch that had the library. They also had this very, very impressive headquarters. As I said, it was actually farther out from the city. It's a little bit farther. Today, it's no longer there, but most of the city lies near the river, which is towards the bottom, and YIVO is all the way at the top of the hill. But yeah.
Gotcha. So getting back to the library, the libraries really now, because the Strassen Library and the YIVO Library are sitting there in Frankfurt, and the Nazis lost the war, obviously. What happened after that, after the Americans came in?
So the Americans come in, and YIVO, as I mentioned, had their own library. And YIVO's library was also similarly, parts of it were sent to Frankfurt. YIVO became aware that some of the library was there, and they immediately made attempts to get the library from Frankfurt, and they wanted to bring it to the United States. And they had a lot of issues with that. It was complicated for a number of reasons. There was a larger issue about restitution of Jewish property after the war. That was a larger issue. They also had an issue, a legal issue, because as I mentioned, the New York was merely a branch of YIVO. There's a question that actually took them a while to resolve whether or not the New York branch could be considered owners of YIVO property at all. Irrespective of whatever regime there is for the restitution, would these even qualify? So it took them a long time, and they were negotiating both with the United States State Department and the United States Army to try to get their own property back. And in the process, they started making claims to the Strauss-Soun library books that were there as well. And ultimately, they were successful in those claims. And when their materials were brought over in July of 1947, those materials also included materials from the Strauss-Soun library. In fact, they included all the materials from the Strauss-Soun library, which was approximately a little over half the books were in Frankfurt and went to YIVO in 1947.
Now, what happened to the books at that point? Was this public knowledge that they got the Strauss-Soun books, or was that not really known? People thought it was the YIVO. What happened?
Right. So what happened was, is for reasons that have never been made entirely clear, YIVO announced it got its books back, and they had on a couple of occasions, they published a story about how they got their books back. They published a story about what happened to the books during the Holocaust, how they were sorted, and then the Frankfurt, and how hard they had to work after the Holocaust, after it even been identified, how difficult it was for them to get their own property back. They did that on a number of occasions, yet they make no mention of the Strauss-Soun library books. Indeed, they make no mention of the Strauss-Soun library books at all until 1962, I believe. And up to that point in time, there no one, it seems, had any idea, or at least it was never publicly acknowledged that half the Strauss-Soun library books were in New York. As I said, it's not entirely clear why that was.
Right. So who discovered this? How was it discovered? How'd they go? What happened?
So what happened was, ultimately it was discovered by a distant relative of Strauss-Soun. In the 50s, he discovered that they had material from the Strauss-Soun library, and they had obtained it through Frankfurt. And he wore two hats. He was both a relative of Strauss-Soun, and he was also the chief librarian, the head librarian at the rabbinic library at Hei Chol Shlomo. His name was Tzvi Harkavy. And Harkavy, for both nationalistic reasons and religious reasons, because YIVO is a secular institution and the rabbinic library was, of course, a religious one, Israel versus the United States, he felt that YIVO should not have those books. And he challenged YIVO's ownership claims to those books. And he did it, he filed a lawsuit in Jerusalem, for what that's worth. But then also as the chief librarian, he negotiated with YIVO to get at least some of those books. And ultimately YIVO agreed to send books to Israel, and they sent a number of books to Israel. After those books were sent is the first time that we have YIVO putting on an exhibition and actually calling out the Strauss-Soun library books in their collection. So it's after the Harkavy challenge is resolved is when we see it for the first time. What prompted it then is anyone's guess.
Harkavy is interesting because the books went to Hei Chol Shlomo. Hei Chol Shlomo is defunct. So what happened to the books after that?
Right. So that's how I got into it. In other words, the book dealer that I bought my book from got it from Hei Chol Shlomo because he got it from the rabbinic library. The rabbinic library there closed down entirely. As is so often the case with books, they're dispersed yet again, and then you get this constant gathering and dispersal.
So do you personally own some of the Strauss-Soun library books?
Yeah, so I own a couple, and there's a couple types, and maybe this is it'll give you some insight into how I collect. So I am interested, among other things, in the Haskalah, Hungarian Haskalah. I'm interested in Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport. He did a lot of things, but he published a book called Erech Milim, which is his attempt to do something with the Aruch, and it's only the first part of it. Didn't get to publish anything beyond that. It's one of his passion projects. I'm very interested in Rappaport. I have many of his books and so on. I'm interested in some of the same topics. So I got a copy of, I wanted to get a copy of Shear's Erech Milim. So the copy that I own is a copy that it's Shear's Erech Milim. Now, of the books, there's two types of books from the Strauss-Soun Library. One are books that Montesquieu personally owned, those 6,500, and then they're larger from the 50,000. So I, of course, wanted a book from Matisyahu's thing. So I have Matisyahu's copy of Rappaport's Erech Milam. Now, it's not only Erech Milam is a Rappaport thing. The reason it's also important is because Matisyahu, one of his passions was the Arif as well, and language. In fact, some of the letters we have are between, in the Jewish newspapers, are between him and Shear about words and definitions and so on. So this is a book that he would have particular interest in, and I have the copy that not only has his stamp in it, but also is one of the handful of books that Hillel Shlomo got that have Matisyahu's marginalia in it. But then I also have another book that actually belonged to Matisyahu. And the reason I have that one is because it's Elias Elio, which is, of course, the first real biography of the Vilna Gaon, and also really kicked off Jewish historiography, which was one of Matisyahu's passions. He wrote his, one of the non-books books that he wrote is this 15 or 18 page note, Rechovos HaKirya, which is on Kirya Ne'amona, the history of Vilna. It's this very, very long, whatever, end note or long thing where he goes off on history and so on. It was one of the things that he did. So I have the Elias Elio copy that he had as well. So that's, you know, something else that I have of his.
Sounds like a typical Maskilic biography. It's just like one line and like all footnotes or endnotes.
That's pretty much what it is. Yes.
Everyone's familiar listening to this will know what we're talking about. But so I'm curious. I want to mention two things. So first of all, Shlomi Yehuda Rappaport was the Abbezneret of Prague, and also was obviously the famous, or many people don't know, the son-in-law of the Ksais HaChayshin and the Magia and the Avd Meluim, as long as being a Maskil, like we'll point out. The thing was, I'm curious just, Did Ramatizio have any connection to Shadal being to languages, or he didn't have any connection to him?
I don't remember if he knew him personally. I believe he did for some reason. I believe he did, but I can't recall specifically now.
I don't recall either. I was just curious because you said that he had a connection to Shear. I know that Shear had a connection with Shadal for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I know he really didn't like Yashar. So I imagine, I just can't remember his position with Shadal right now, but Yashar he hated vehemently. He had a bunch of articles writing against him. But Shadal, I just don't remember right now.
Right. I mean, Yashar was different than Shadal, but yeah. Most people, Yitzchak Shmuel Rigio. So I guess we should tell people if they don't know any idea who he is. I actually just got a set of his Chumashim recently. I know.
Yes,
they right. Actually were reprinted. They were redone, evidently, a number of years ago. I didn't
correct.
Know.
Correct. Redone by a guy who didn't know he was redoing it. So the story, I don't know if it's apocryphal, was that someone told him and then they pulled him from the shelf that he was horrified that he did it. Yeah. So I also have the Chumash, but there was also a prospectus he published that he has a long period thing on Torah Shva Peh. That's a separate thing for the Chumash. I also have that. It's much smaller. Anyways, his Hakdama is very important, Reggio, because he justifies going off script, if you will, the ability to ignore Piyushim from the Rishonim on Chumash and so on, and the importance of doing it on your own. In fact, he criticizes Mendelssohn and Mendelssohn's beer because he says Mendelssohn's beer, this is what no one realizes, Mendelssohn's beer, he says, it's just essentially all the Rishonim. It's this art scroll. That's exactly what the beer is. Like it's not the beer. It's the other stuff. But the beer itself, the text called the beer is simply a collection of that. And Reggio faults him. He said he doesn't add anything. So Reggio was coming along to offer a Pirush that actually added something. Anyways, sorry that.
Yeah, we got off on Bible. Actually, I had a podcast with Micha Gottlieb of NYU about Mendelssohn, and we discussed it. But he's actually just putting out a book now on German Bible translations. And it's coming out soon, but I don't know if you're familiar with him. So we talked about the beer a little bit, and he kind of told people, you know, make it known to people. But I guess we should finish up getting back to Matsyo in the library. So the library today is at Evo. I think things are scanned. It is accessible. Did you ever speak to them at all? Or they did? I think you alluded to the book. You didn't. They didn't really speak to you at all, right?
Yeah, it's a complicated relationship. Yeah, so they scanned a whole bunch of books. We'll see how many. Yeah, at one point there was 25,000. I don't know what there is now. But they certainly have had an amazing project of late where they've scanned both books and documents, and they've done a great, great job with that. I think that they finished scanning, but not all of it has been published online yet. But certainly they were supposed to scan everything from the Straussman Library that they have. They're not the only ones scanning, because the books, as I mentioned, actually not only reside in New York with YIVO, some went to Israel and those were dispersed, you know, as we talked about before, but then there was also those books that were stuck in a bunker and they survived the war. In fact, there's this crazy happenstance, I don't know how else to describe it, happenstance that it was in one bunker. It was actually on, there's a street in Vilna called Strausun Street. It was named after Matisyahu Strausun. Today it's been reverted to its Lithuanian name, but it was called Strausun Street. And the bunker that they put the books in was at 6 Strausun Street. And then 2 days before the Germans came, they moved the books to the bunker next door at 4. Just before the Germans left, they discovered the bunker in 6 and destroyed everything in it, and the books survived in 4. After the war, when Jews came back, they uncovered it, and those books still remain in Lithuania today. And those books are scanned as well. So it's not only the books in New York that have been scanned, it's also some of the books in Lithuania have also been scanned.
So today there's a way to access. People that are interested, they can definitely see the books and they are accessible again publicly.
You can see some of them, yes.
Right, not all of them. So I guess to stop. So thank you very much for coming on. I think I'll post the link to the book in the podcast, and there's more discussed in the book. You go more in depth on YIVO and all the characters in YIVO and who were involved. Lucy Davidowitz, right? And I think they just put out a biography on her. Someone just wrote a book about her. So there's more in there. There's other books I mentioned, David Fishman. Then there's the book Elizabeth Gallus put out the book, right? That's also related. What's the title of the book?
Mortuary of books.
So there's a lot of books written about books post Holocaust. I don't know if everyone gets bored of this. Your book is definitely not boring. I've read it and it's quite gripping. So it's not just about dusty old books. So people definitely should check it out. And I'll post the link. So thank you very much.
Thank you.